Good morning. My name's Scott Lee, and I'm an alcoholic, and very moved and not embarrassed by it. I am grateful to be here, and what an honor. And Bob, thank you very much. And thanks to Alan, who I'm sure did most of the work, as I know Bob. And one of the things that I noticed about this particular conference was that part of my responsibility as a speaker is to throw a few barbs at Bob, so I'll work those in as best I can. I'm a member of the backroom group in Nashville, Tennessee. And I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I sponsor some guys. I have some commitments. And what a privilege it is for me to be able to talk about this 12th step. I'm going to tell a little piece of my story. I'm going to try to do what Bob suggested in this last session, and that's to be me, to not to teach. I'm one of the technicians, but to try to give you this piece from in here as it applies for me to that 12th step. I have to lay a little groundwork to get to that. I'll do that as quickly as I can. But I used to drink booze. And I did. And it worked for me for a long time. I was put in treatment on June the 28th of 1984, which is my sobriety date, by a business partner, senior partner, who wanted me to overcorrect for a problem I didn't have. I know you understand that. And I zipped through the 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And I've always been a quick study. And I got back to Nashville where I had, within about a month and a half or 2 months, I'd done everything on their aftercare plan except get a sponsor. And I didn't come to talk to you. I came to talk with you. So please play with me. All right? And you guys have been around a long time, so you're going to be able to do this. This is a two-word fill-in-the-blank. All right? I'm an insane newcomer. There's only one characteristic I'm sure that I need in a sponsor. Okay? I'm looking for a sponsor I can relate to, you bet. Isn't that insane? Yeah, I mean, really. Really. I have attempted to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I've gone to 87. I can't remember the other two, but there was one particular evening I was about to leave for the meeting and my son injured himself badly. We went to the emergency room instead of the meeting. It's the right thing. And so I missed that night. And I thought if you missed, you just missed. I didn't know you could go to two meetings in a day. Because I've got a terminal case of newcomer thinking. And it is going to kill me if I don't get some help with it pretty soon. And so I'm looking for a sponsor I can relate to. Who can I relate to? You know, I can relate to some other curveball that's never been anywhere near the strike zone. That's who I can relate to. And what I needed was a sponsor I would obey, which is kind of a new concept for me. My history and my MO is that I'm going to understand the rules as thoroughly as possible so I can break them effectively and get away with it. And I've been doing it for four decades when I get to you. Very effectively. I cut my own Vietnam tour 17 days short. I know how to, I'm going to get around it. That's just what I do. And this guy in this meeting, his lights were on. Do you know what I mean? These speakers this weekend, their lights have been on. And haven't they been fantastic? Can you believe this? Just absolutely spectacular. And so I said, would you sponsor me? And he said the words that changed my life. He said, you're too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I didn't have the faintest notion what he was talking about. And he said until he died that he thought the single best kept secret in our fellowship was the definition of our program. He said the way we keep it secret, of course, is that we read it at almost every meeting. It's on page 59 where it says, here are the steps we took or just suggested as a program of recovery. No steps, no program. He said it was just that simple. And he said, you're going to work the steps the way I lay them out at the pace I set, or I'm going to drop you like a bad habit because I don't work with losers. And he scared me, but not badly enough. And I was honest with my sponsor at that moment. And I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. I said, I don't think we're communicating. He said, sure we are. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when you do what your sponsor says, whether you want to or not. And I needed some definitions. I needed some help. And he asked me if I'd ever quit on my own. So you ever quit drinking on your own? I said, yeah. He said, how many times? I said, well, I'm not exactly sure. It's somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000. I'm a puker. Any other pukers in the house? Please. Come on. Up. I'm proud. Come on. Way up. Thank you. That's great. How about nose pukers? Ever come out your nose? Ever? A nose? One of the things you'll notice about nose pukers is they tend to quit forever when they're puking out their nose. And, that's right. And, who quit forever solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses at least once? Come on. I know you're here. These are my people. All right. Who peed in the closet? Did you really? I never did that. I'm very embarrassed for you. I don't believe I'd have told that. Big difference between a fifth step and sharing in a meeting. I will admit that my first wife's still angry about that antique coffee table we used to have in the living room. I'll give you that. Who's taken meetings into jails and prisons? Come on. Yeah, I'm not at all surprised in this crowd. For anyone else, if you're suffering from depression, get with one of these people and one time take a meeting into a correctional facility. See if it doesn't break your depression. I think you'll find it might. I was in Depod in the county lockup one night. I was playing with them like I was just playing there, and I said, who peed in the closet? And it was the first time I'd ever done that. 25 inmates, they don't laugh much in the jail. One guy put his hand up. They laughed that night. I worked him over. And when the laughter finally died down, he said, hey, man, no big deal. It wasn't my closet. It's a perspective thing, I suppose. But my situation was that I could quit forever and mean it. And as I'm sure you know, alcoholics all know, forever runs somewhere between 20 minutes and about 8 weeks. Right? Is that about right on forever? The earthlings, don't talk to them about forever. It'll scare you how long they think it is. We know it only runs a couple of months at the most. And I feel better, work better, having a better time. I go through that routine. So I quit forever, but I can't get unthirsty. It's the peace I can never seem to find on my own. And I might be unthirsty for a period of time, a month or 6 weeks. Don't even think about it. But something's always coming where I'm going to get thirsty again. I own my own business. I'm going to close a big deal, make a lot of money. I'm going to get thirsty. Lose a big deal, lose a lot of money. I'm going to get thirsty. Get a new convertible. I'm going to get thirsty. I'm going to get a new girlfriend. I'm married, by the way. I'm going to get a new girlfriend. I'm going to get thirsty. I'm going to get a new boat, or the big one that's going to hit. Redskins are going to play the Cowboys on Monday night. And I'm going to get thirsty. There's something always coming where I'm going to get thirsty. This is the peace I can't get unthirsty. It's a peace I could never find by myself. And, back in Tennessee, we say one day at a time a lot. I know y'all say that here. But if there's anybody new, there's a second line to that they're not telling you. What they really mean is one day at a time in a row. With like no breaks ever is really what they mean. So if I'm going to stay sober one day at a time in a row, this is the peace I'm going to have to get. And for me, I think the most powerful promise in our book is the first line on page 60. It says 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say a result, it says the, that's singular. It's my experience that spiritually awakened alcoholics don't drink beverage alcohol and they don't ever get thirsty. I have been continuously unthirsty since sometime in December of 1984. I got a sponsor sometime in late October, early November, and somewhere in the step process, I had the last urge that I can remember. The thought, you know, drops through every once in a while, but it doesn't stay. I had a sponsor that told me that I'm not responsible for what I think. I'm responsible for how long I think it. That I can't keep it from getting dirty up here. When it does, I can sweep. That's my responsibility, is to keep it as clean as I can. I want to read all of step 12 here on page 60, because it seems to me to have three different ideas in it that are very much interrelated. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I'm not sure so much the 12th step is what I'm told to do as to who I become as the result of these steps. A young fellow I sponsor is over a year and a half now, and I was on a phone with him the other day. And I have permission to tell any story you hear me tell, by the way. And he said, you've already told me I can't take anybody else on to sponsor, but I've got this something inside me. I want to go take meetings into treatment centers or jails or detoxes or something. Is that okay? I said, yeah. Yeah, that'll be okay. I understand is that he emerges as a need. At 6 months, started doing public information. The group I was in didn't have a public information chair. As it turned out, I don't think there was a public information committee in the city of Nashville, so I was it. A few months later, my sponsor came to me and he said, "You have gotten more radio and television minutes and more column inches in the newspaper for Alcoholics Anonymous than the rest of the state combined. That is not attraction, that is promotion. You are finished forever in public information." And you will stay away from that. I want you in treatment centers and jails. And so that's what I started doing. And I called one of the local jails and talked to the program manager, who I didn't happen to know that she was in recovery. And I said, "I'd like to bring a meeting into your jail. May I?" And she said, "We'd love to have you. When would you like to come?" I said, "I think I want to come Monday nights at 8 o'clock. She said, "Well, that slot's open. How'd you pick it?" I said, "I want to compete with Monday Night Football, because I think that will change the people that come to the meeting." And that's been my experience with it. I've had the privilege of taking meetings into the jails for about 22 years, and it's been so good for me. I'll tell you, the ones that are the best for me are the night when my team's playing and I don't want to go. And I tell Miss Linda, "You know, I just don't want to do it tonight." She listens, but she knows I'm going. And I don't know it, but she knows. And those are the ones that I come out a foot off the ground with tears running down my face. It's a spectacular thing. I know many of you are doing that. I've got a few of these. We got a phone call about 5 years ago from the program director at the sheriff's office. Davidson County and Nashville are the same thing. It's a metro. And the sheriff of Davidson County really backs what we do. He wants us in there. He says that in excess of 90% of his inmates are there as a direct result of alcoholism and drug addiction. And he's not warehousing people and he's not punishing them. He's trying to rehabilitate them so they don't reoffend. And he said, "I've got a GED school. I have a literacy school. I've got a chef school. I got a number of schools in my jails. But the fact is, if we don't get the A&D piece fixed, everything else we're doing is a waste of time. And we've got the keys to the jail." I think my home group has taken, I believe, right at 60 meetings a month into jails and prisons. We got about 120 members in my group. Our ladies are doing about a third of that. And anyway, about 5 years ago, the sheriff's had a all-volunteers, thanks-for-coming dinner kind of thing, and we attended, and they asked what we could do that would be better, and we were talking, and one of the staff members at the sheriff's office said, "Well, you guys keep talking about these steps. Could you come in on a weekend and take some inmates to the steps?" And we said, "We think the only problem we're going to have on that is that we can't bring our whole team in to do that, and those that don't get to come in are going to be upset." And they were, and we told them they could be the next one. And so we started, and our men were in the jail yesterday in Nashville. There were 9 of them that took around 50 inmates through the steps. I'm not sure the number on the inmates. I know it was 9 of our guys. And not that they did all the steps, but something not too dissimilar from what we've done this weekend. And the report that we get back consistently, the warden requires them to do a critique sheet. We don't ask for that, but they give them to us, and they all say the same thing. "Now I understand why I'm back in jail. I didn't do the steps. Now I understand why I didn't stay sober. I didn't do the steps. Now I'm no longer afraid of step 4. I'm no longer afraid of step 5. That's what we get consistently. And these guys are now showing up at our groups, and it's been a fantastic thing to be part of. If you have any interest in trying to do something like that, I've got a letter from my sheriff signed by him recommending this to anybody who's interested. He's willing to talk to your sheriff or your warden. And kind of a format of what we do is on the back of it. I got a few of these. When I get through talking, if somebody's interested, I'd be happy to give you one. But it's just been a joy for us to do it. None of us has ever walked out of one of those thirsty. Never have. a spiritual awakening for me. I had a particular moment. I was lying in a bed in a treatment center, and I hadn't slept the first three nights and realized I wasn't going to sleep again tonight. And some of you may recall, if you're not sleeping, you're not drinking, it stays dark kind of a long time at night. And man, I'm laying there. And my life passed in review, not an instantaneous thing, but over the course of several hours, I saw my life. And it wasn't a very pretty movie. I've always given myself credit for my intentions. I have some wonderful intentions. My favorite one, I used to do amateur magic close-up. And one of these days, I'm going to get a clown suit. When I'm on the road, instead of running the saloons and chasing the girls, I'm going to put on the clown suit and go to a children's hospital with my magic kit and do a show for the kids. And I think you'd say it'd take a great guy. But I haven't done that yet, by the way. But take a really great guy to do that. And I had intentions, and anyway, I was living on my intentions, and our third step talks about a decision. The difference for me is that intentions followed by more intentions, and decisions followed by action. And this night, as I saw my life, I didn't get to see the intentions. They were just gone. And boy, it's not pretty without them. And I finally reached what I call bottom. And this is just my experience with it. I don't find the definition of the bottom in our literature. And I know men serving long prison sentences as a direct result of alcoholism that are planning to drink when they get out. I have puked blood, and not just once. And I've been in lots of kinds of trouble. None of that was bottom. For me, bottom wasn't on the physical plane. Bottom was in here, where I was so repulsed by me and what I'd done that I would have paid any price for relief from that. I'd have given anything just to be somebody else. And at that point, this is not easy to describe, but I'm lying on my back in a bed with my eyes closed. My roommate is asleep right over there. The lights are out. It's somewhere in the wee hours. My soul, it must have been, because what I'm telling you happened in my chest. It didn't happen up here. Screamed for forgiveness. God, forgive me, were the words, but they were said from something in here very loudly. And suddenly, as I said those, in the next instant, all of this happened, and there was this magnificent light shining just on me and on my bed, but it was also illuminating the room because I could see that room better, much better than I can see this one with my eyes closed. I could see the detail all over it. And there was a physical experience similar to when you've had x-rays taken of your teeth and they finish, they pick up that lead apron, that very heavy thing, that there was something heavy laying all over my body that I was unaware of until that moment, and it flew off of me. And it felt like it just, I mean, it was unbelievable, the speed. My body felt so light, it felt like I was going to float up off of the bed. I thought I was going to float. And I knew in that moment that there was a God, that that God had the power to forgive me and that I was forgiven. And I laid there in His presence for a while, and I can report to you that what we call time doesn't exist in that presence, and I can't explain that. But might have been a couple of seconds, it might have been a couple of hours, I don't know. I'm not aware of anything else that passed between us. The light felt so good that it almost hurt, and I don't understand that, but that's right. And after that, I slept. And I know that because the next morning I woke up, and I hadn't had that experience in several days. And I woke up wanting to be one of His guys, and that was my first cornerstone. And if you feel like you've been robbed because you didn't have one of those, this is page 12 in Bill's story. But soon the sense of His presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those of them myself. I don't believe that experience alone would have kept me sober 23 years and change. It was necessary for me to do the rest of it. That was just kind of a cornerstone for a last gasper like me, because that's what I was. And anyway, the sponsor started working with me, and the great joy for me has been trying to carry this message to others. I'm going to read to you from page 89. I'm sure you all know all of this, but it moves me. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. So important. I want to salute the Al-Anons. I know there's some Al-Anons here. Would you just raise your hands for us? Thank you for attending. The Al-Anon International is coming 4th of July weekend in Pittsburgh. You can go to their website and find out about it. Miss Linda and I have decided we're going to go to that. If I find Al-Anon supports, well, I'm going to try not to editorialize. I have an opinion there. But y'all sure have been good to us. And I believe your co-founder saved us when Bill was sober just a few months, and he went to Lois and he said, I've been working with all these guys and none of them are staying sober. And Lois said, you have. My life hung by that thread. I want to salute the Al-Anons. Thank you so much for what you've done, for what all of your, everyone has done for us. It's easy to get into semantics. I was going to say, I agree with absolutely everything I heard this weekend. Almost. And and one of the gifts of my awakening is that I don't have to agree with everything somebody says to be able to stay present, to not have an argument with them in my head and continue to hear and learn from them. And that's been big for me. There was a moment this morning, I told Miss Linda I had this topic, and she said, talk about this a little bit. There was a moment this morning when I was asleep, and the very next moment I was awake. But 10 seconds later, I was more awake. And 5 minutes later, I was more awake. And when I stepped out of the shower, I was more awake. And for me, spiritual awakening has been that way, mostly seen in retrospect. There's a wonderful thing in the ninth step promises. It says, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. It doesn't say God will suddenly begin to do for us. It says my realization will be sudden. And that's how it's been for me. It's been a series of fits and starts. And I have, you know, my third step decision stands. I got some days I implement it better than others, but it stands. One of the things that I started doing a number of years ago and that I require of the men that I sponsor is to exchange phone numbers with new men, not to just give him your number. You know, I give the new guy my number, I feel better, game, set, and match. That's all that's going to happen. I require myself and the men I sponsor to exchange phone numbers with the new guy and to call him twice in the next 3 days is the parameter I'm currently using. Not to chase him, but to say, hey, Stanley, you know, I met you at the back room group yesterday. I talked to five or six guys every day that are on that are in recovery. You're on today's list. How's it going? I'm going to the men's meeting tonight down to Presbyterian Church, 8 o'clock. Why don't you meet me there? We'll have a cup of coffee, chat a little bit. It's nothing for me to pick up the phone and call him. He can't call me. The receiver on his phone weighs 1,000 pounds, and he can't pick it up. And it's nothing for me to call him. And I want to talk about precedent. Roland Hazard got sober in the Oxford groups, and when he had a few months, he called his old he went and found his old buddy, Ebbie Thatcher, who was standing before the judge about to be incarcerated forever in an insane asylum for alcoholic insanity. They got Ebbie sober in the Oxford groups, and when he had a few months, he called his old drinking buddy, Bill Wilson. And when Bill Wilson had 6 months, he made the phone call that led him to Dr. Bob. We have a little bit of precedent of somebody who's been around for a while calling somebody that hadn't. So it's not like we don't have precedent. And we say this thing about the hand of AA always being there. Wonder what would happen if we could reach it out a little bit further. They're dying, you know. They're dying. Y'all sure made me welcome. I think maybe the two most important things we do are making newcomers welcome and making those who were here for a while and tried it again, making it easier for them to come back. If you're coming back, get with me. I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'll do everything I can to make this easy for you to come back. Because if I go back out, please God, do that for me. I got nowhere else to go. It's a life or death. You know, it's not a seniority contest. I'm proud to be sober 23 years and be one of the rookies on this panel. But it's not a seniority contest, and that's one of the things I tell the ones that are coming back. It's not a seniority contest. This is life or death today. It's actually slightly more important than life or death today, is what I believe it is. When I was sober about 5 years, I called this particular sponsor. I'm going to talk about him a lot. And I said, blah, 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 this particular guy I'm sponsoring. And he said, I want you to drop him. And I said, Mike, I'm being serious. And he said, I'm being serious. I want you to drop him. I would rather have you on the golf course than working with him be better for your program. Well, he's never heard me play golf. And clearly. And I said, come on, be serious. He says, I'm being serious. Let me ask you some questions. I said, well, okay. He said, what are you asking him to do that he's not doing? I said, well, let's see. Call me every day, go to a meeting every day, start his four-step, call his parole officer, look for a job, and follow the directions on pages 86 and 87 on how to open and close your day. He said, well, how much of that's he doing? I said, well, he's not doing any of it. He said, you are not his sponsor, he is. You are his fire chief. And when his tail feathers are ablaze, he calls you and siphons off some of your serenity and puts out his fire and goes right back to doing it his way, and you are not helping him. You are not helping him. You're co-signing a lie, and the lie is that he has a sponsor and he doesn't. And the lie is that he's in the program of recovery and he's not. And he says, I want you to drop him. I said, man, and these are hard things. And he said, how do you feel when you work with him? And I said, I feel like they pulled the corks out of my heels and the blood ran out. And I feel like I've been wrung out. And he said, how do you feel when you work with Bill Kay? I said, oh, he lights me up like a pinball machine. He said, really, what are you asking Bill to do that he's not doing? I said, oh, he's doing it all. He said, mm-hmm. Imagine that. And I began to get the idea that sponsorship is a two-way street. And then he asked me a great question. He said, could you stay sober on the program this guy's working? I said, no. He said, can he? I said, I don't think so. He said, you are probably right. And when he drinks again, he may kill somebody or himself or do major damage or go to prison for a long time. And I want you to be able to sleep because you have done the right thing. Because you've told him the truth. Because right now, what we're really doing is we're wagering on your ability as a psychologist. And it's a bad choice. That's a bad bet. And I've since added something to that, and that is that the next time he wakes up in a jail cell in a pool of his own blood and vomit, I want him to have three options. And the options are to continue to live that way, to commit suicide, or try the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing he hadn't tried it because I told him the truth. Because if I don't tell him the truth, look what I've left for him. So I'm making it easy for him to come back when I drop him. And before you come disagree with me, I'd ask you to read the middle paragraph on page 95 and the first one on page 96, where the text tells me to do that. And it's a hard thing. And I went with heavy heart. And I was hoping he'd say, no, give me one more chance. And he didn't. And he said, yeah, okay. And the next time I saw him after that was a few days later, and he bounced off of both door jams coming into the clubhouse. And the officers came in and arrested him out of the clubhouse. We shared a parking lot with a grocery store. He left his vehicle parked up against somebody else's. And that was the last time I saw him. And I hope he comes back. But he doesn't think I'm his sponsor. And he doesn't think he's in the program because I told him the truth. And it broke my heart. And I had experience just a few years ago. I was trying to work with a particular guy, and I realized that I was putting more energy into his sponsoring him than into his program than he was. Is the best way I know how to say it. I'm calling him, he's not calling me. And I finally realized it, and I said, you're not letting me work with you. I got to drop you. It's the only fair thing to do. And he said, no, God, I'll do anything, please. That's what I want him to say. I say, okay, I want you to read the first four pages in Bill's story. I want you to get a dictionary, look up two words on every page. Call me tonight at 8:15. 8:15 tonight, my phone rings. He's looked up eight words. He tells me the definitions. Okay. I learned it from the Al-Anons. Don't tell me, show me. No, I don't trust the words. Trust the actions. And so we work for a while, and 2-3 weeks later, I'm putting more energy into his recovery than he is. So we have that, and he says, no, please, I'll do anything. So I give him something else I can check up on, and trying to get him through the work. And I don't know how many times we did that. And I told my sponsor about it, and he said, this is the last time. The next time you have to have that conversation with him, make it stick. And I had to have it with him a couple of weeks later, and I said, you're not letting me sponsor you, and I can't in good conscience continue. And I always give him the definition of the program as Jerry showed it to me. And I said, you're just not letting me do it, and I've got to drop you. In good conscience, I can't continue. He said, no, please, I'll do anything. I said, no, I'm going to last chance you in your grave. There's a country song, give me one more last chance. I think maybe one of our people wrote that. And I said, I hope you'll get a sponsor that you'll surrender to. I hope you'll allow someone to take you through this work. And he'll tell you today that I saved his life that day, that he was doing just enough. And he went and got another long-term member of our home group and surrendered to him. And this guy's on fire today. another fellow that I tried to sponsor, and he could stay sober. Whenever I was in town, he was sober the whole time. That's great. I'm traveling 2 weekends a month. And finally, after about 4 months, I spotted the pattern. It said, this is not working, and let's get you somebody else. And I just called him a couple days ago. He celebrated 4 years. So I'm not the best sponsor for everybody. I have to admit it when I'm at a place where I can't do what needs to be done for someone. I don't find the term sponsor in the text, but it's all over the stories in the 12 and 12, but in the basic text I didn't find it. But I found the description of sponsorship, what looks to me like on page 96. It's been talking for a couple of pages about a 12-step call where you went and somebody said they might like some help, and so you went and called on them and tell a little piece of your story. They told some of theirs. You laugh, you cry, you leave them the book. Says, suppose you're now making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume, says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. To me, it defines someone who's sponsorable. He's made an attempt to read the book. Chances are the voice is loud, his head is so loud, his retention isn't real high. Have you ever had the experience of your eyes are moving across the page and your mind is moving across the universe? When I get that one, what I've discovered is that I read out loud, I can trap my mind in the moment. I recommend that to him. So that to me is, and I love the language, it says he's prepared to go through with, I'll go through with the 12 steps. That's what go through with looks like. I'll go through with. Well, that's good. We'll settle for that. We don't get that many eager ones. I heard Bob say this the other day. He said, we don't believe that we've ever had an alcoholic walk into his first meeting, stand and read the steps and say, oh yeah, that would work for me. That's what I need to do. We don't get that. I'll go through with the 12 steps. Okay, great. And then I think it describes sponsors. It says, having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. What experience? Experience on going through the 12 steps, what advice? Advice on how to go through the 12 steps. And that really kind of defines it for me. My problem is, as was described so beautifully this weekend by everybody else, well, I'll quote the noted American philosopher Alfred E. Newman, who, you younger people can ask those that laughed, they'll know. Who once said, most people don't know what they want, but they're pretty sure they haven't got it. And that's my history. I love this line on page 61. It says, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? That I still fall victim to that. And that if I can just get at that. And I think my problem, that we could get into semantics pretty easily, but this is my perspective, is that I had happiness and pleasure confused. And I believe that there's something out there that will bring me pleasure for a limited time. But it's always limited. Happiness for me is an inside job. It's a side effect of having a healthy relationship with God and with all of you, which is produced in an alcoholic like me by doing the 12 steps. And I needed a player coach. I needed a sponsor who had actually done it. I've never heard of a great coach in any game of any kind who didn't play the game. I had to have somebody that had heart knowledge, not just book knowledge. And that's really what this thing continues to come down to. It comes down to having it in here. And for me, that's been intermittent. And I have times, and I'm bad to judge. And boy, that gets me nothing but trouble. I had a wonderful time a number of years ago. I had one of my teachers trapped in a hotel lobby for a couple hours, and I was firing questions at him, and he was giving me answers, and I couldn't believe it. It was just fantastic. And at one point, he stopped and said, well, let me ask you a question. I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to get a chance to impress him. He said, here on page 62, you agreed to quit playing God. I said, yes. He said, how'd you play God? I said, I don't know. He said, here's how I played God. I became angry when someone died, and that's me saying I know who should die and how and when. Clearly, that's me playing God. I tried to manage my own life and the lives around me, and the closer you were to me, the harder I tried to manage your life. And I judged people, and the way I know I judged them is I had resentments. And the only way to get a resentment is to judge someone, find them guilty, be angry with them, and then feel that anger again. By definition, in English, that's what a resentment is, to re-feel some old anger. So I judged. And then I found some others for myself. One of mine is that I ask why. When I ask why, I'm playing God. Because when I ask why, I'm never really looking for an answer. I'm looking for a fight. I'm looking for something I can argue with. Never looking for an answer. And I'm saying if St. Scott can get all of the steel, just paste it all together, it'll be fine. Or I'm saying to myself, you're an idiot, and if you'll answer why, I'll show you how. Playing God again. And another one is that I was sure that everything I knew for sure was correct. And anybody who disagreed with me was clearly a fool. Boy, that'll block your learning completely. That just shut it right down. There's a wonderful line in here. Howard said it was on page 42. And it says, it meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. And in plain old Tennessee English, what that says is that some of what I know for sure ain't so. That it isn't what I don't know that's killing me so much. It's what I know for sure that isn't correct that's blocking me. And for me, part of this whole process has been to learn to release my grip on what I know for sure. And I give you an example from my experience. I surrendered a lot when I was new. And I like the surrender term in the military connotation of, you know, loud noises and blood and screaming. That's me screaming, my blood. And I finally surrender. And then I surrender again. I surrender again. Woke up this morning, didn't surrender. I volunteered. Similar result comes from a very different place. I volunteered this morning in my own enlightened self-interest. Because I'm more awake now spiritually than I was when I first got here and had to continue to surrender. Because part of that sleepiness had to do with still believing if I can get what I want, it will make me happy. This is fun for me anyway. Some examples. Play with me. Who when you were a child wanted a bike? You were certain if you could get a bike, you'd be happy and you get a bike. Anybody? Great. Thanks. Are you happy? Let's try another one. Who wanted him or her? Sure, if you could get them, you'd be happy. And you got them. Let's see it. Okay. Now, I'll give you a break. You could be sitting next to him. I want to ask the other question. Who should get rid of him or her? Yeah, sure. So I don't know. And I think one of the most difficult things for me is to step out of the judgment business. I had an experience, one of the first times I ever talked at a conference, and Vince and I were talking about it earlier, and sometimes it just feels so warm and it's fun and everybody laughs and it's just grand, and boy, sometimes it's cold as ice. And about the third one I talked at, it was that way, and it really upset me. And I thought, geez, this is awful. And I walked around for 2 years thinking that was a terrible talk. And 2 years later, I was at a conference near there, and a woman came up to me and said, oh, my God, what you said saved my life. And I thought, okay, you bet. And what I learned was that it's really fair for me to say I enjoyed this one more than that one. But I got to get out of the business of saying this was a good conference and that was a bad one. This was a good talk. That was a bad one. This is a good event. That's a bad one. I don't know. I get that wrong too much. If you'd asked me my first day sober, what kind of day are you having? It would have taken me 2 hours to tell you the air would have been blue for a mile and a half downwind when I got through. And I can't look back today and say that was a bad day because I'm just wrong. And I am just wrong and wrong and wrong. And it just goes on that way. So when I step out of the judgment business, it gives me peace. And this is an aside, and forgive me. It's just how it's something I've picked up recently that I think may hold. I have discovered the source of all of my anger. Bob touched on it. All of my anger comes from being right. I have never been angry when I wasn't also right. I have been right when I wasn't angry, but I haven't been angry when I wasn't right. And if I grant that everybody has good motive, I don't get angry with them. And somebody asked Al Capone one time, why were you involved in prostitution and gambling and drugs and all that? And he said, I'm just trying to get people the things they wanted. Al Capone had a good motive. Well, I'm capable of that kind of thinking. That last phrase in the 12th step, excuse me, to practice these principles in all our affairs, I missed that for a long. They don't change the big book, but they change mine. You know what I mean? You read it, and that couldn't have been there. Surely I would have seen this before if it had been here. Well, to carry this message to alcoholics and to have good motives on all our affairs, I swear it's what it used to say. And down at the bottom of that page, it talks about we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. And I got that lesson. This was part of my awakening. It was one of my awakenings. I'm a commissioned salesman. I call on major accounts. I call on purchasing agents at key accounts. I had a particular purchasing agent in my category at a key account that represented a third of my income, and I was making pretty good money in those days. He could have easily multiplied what he bought from me by 3 or 4 or 5 by adding additional items in my category. He and I were personal friends. Our wives were friends. We're guests in each other's homes. He and I have spiritual discussions, but never a religious one. He's a Lutheran. I don't know today what that means. We didn't talk about that. We talked about he was an amazing guy. I get a phone call from him one day, and he says, my wife has just given birth. Well, I'm close enough to know that that's about 2 months early. And he said, the news isn't good. Can you come down here to this hospital and pray over this child? I said, you bet. Hopped in my car, 10-minute drive to Vanderbilt Hospital. I did what I've been hearing in meetings for so long. Check your motives. That's what I'm doing. I'm checking my motives. I can't answer the question. I don't know whether I'm going down to that hospital to pray over that child to try to bring spiritual relief to this family or to try to get closer to this guy so that he'll put some more cash in my pocket. I can't answer the question. And I believe this, that when I can't get an answer, one or two things is in place. I've either asked the wrong question, and the right question on the wrong day is still the wrong question, or it's okay that I make a mistake here, because all my lessons don't seem to be able to be learned without mistakes. Or maybe I need to make a mistake here and go through this so that somebody I don't even see can watch me, because I can go through it and they couldn't. See, and I signed on for that when I prayed that third step prayer. I said, take me. I don't have any more questions. But I did what I'd been told, and I pulled into a parking space and I prayed. And I don't remember my prayer, but it was something like, Father, I need some help, and I need some right now, please. I don't ask you to believe this came from God. I believe it did. The next thing I got was a thought, a very clear thought in the form of a question. The question was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? The answer was no. The answer was no. And the principles that underlie that are that there are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. There are likewise no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. That I'm not going to get God's ends using Satan's means. And that has helped me step out of the business of motive. Because I'm the guy that came up with a good motive for going to bed with my best friend's wife and get caught and devastated two families back in my drinking days. I can come up like Al Capone with a good motive. My motives scare me to death. I hope for better ones. I pray for them. But this thing continues to be about principle. And when I get to principle, I do well. What really happens for me, and I don't mean to be philosophical, but this is my experience with it. When I operate from motive, I'm really playing God, because I'm deciding how it should come out. When I operate from motive, I'm governing results. When I operate from principle, I'm doing what I think God wants me to do, irrespective of result. I'm leaving the result in His hand. And that's just my experience with it. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I was sponsored and how I sponsor, and I'm not suggesting this to anybody. But for step 12, for me, that's a major part of step 12. And I thought for the longest time that my first responsibility to the men that I sponsored was to take them through the steps, and I think that's second now. I believe my first responsibility is to love them. When I'm told that God is love, and when I give love, I give God. And I have received the gift that I love the men that I sponsor deeply. It's amazing when I talk to them how it lights me up. I know most of you know what I'm talking about. And then I think my second responsibility is to coach them through the steps by assignment. I need to know about his life. I need to know, is he single and living on a trust fund? Is he got a wife and 5 kids and working 2.5 jobs? I need to know about him a little bit. I don't believe that recovery from alcoholism should have a negative impact on any other aspect of my life. It should be dead gum inconvenient at times, but it shouldn't have a negative impact. So I need to know some things about him before I can come up with something that makes sense for us. A lady named Mary Jane, as a former trustee up in the Northeast, says that this spiritual stuff, that it doesn't really count if it's not inconvenient. When you're going to do something, it doesn't count if it's not inconvenient. And I think that's right. And so I take them through the steps by assignment, and that's how I was taken through it. That's really all I know to do. I like to cheer for their growth. I'm on a constant search for something good to say to these guys. You know, we've beaten ourselves up enough. Bob and I were, I can't remember where we were, and this guy, as a matter of fact, I think he's in the room. It might have been Tom that said this one, that there are three kinds of people that get to AA. They're atheists, agnostics, and the condemned. Is that you, Tom? Where are you? Anyway, I believe that's right, that those of us who get here believing there's a God get here having committed the unforgivable sin. And that may not be universal, but I think that's pretty high. We've beaten ourselves up enough. I had the privilege of listening, and I wish I could call his first name. One of Betty Ford's sons spoke in Nashville a while back. And this is a story that his mother told. She said the hummingbird and the buzzard fly over the same field, one of them looking for something ugly and one of them looking for something beautiful. And they both find what they're looking for. Are you a hummingbird or are you a buzzard? Wow. I'm trying to learn to be a hummingbird. But I like to cheer for their growth. And my favorite time to cheer for their growth, my favorite is when they admit that they've lied to me. Right? I just love that. Isn't that wonderful? And he calls me, right? He calls me and he says, I have this reputation for being very hard-nosed sponsor. I don't know how that happened because I'm very, very easy, as long as I'm getting my own way. And he calls me, I can hear the heavy heart, and he says, I told you I went to 7 meetings last week and I only went to 6. I lied to you. And I say, congratulations, isn't that fantastic? Look how much you've grown. I mean, you used to lie for credit when you could have got cash for the truth. I mean, I knew he was going to lie to me the day before I met him. He's an alcoholic. That's what they do. Right? And I say, isn't that fantastic? I mean, you have grown so much that you can't live with that little lie. Isn't that fabulous? I'm so proud of you. Look how far you've come. Isn't that great? It does two things. One of them, it's true. And it gives us a chance to be the hummingbird. The second one is it erases from his mind forever the phrase, there's no reason to call Scott with us. I know what he's going to say. He got no idea what I'm going to say from then forward because I have really rocked him. And I think it's actually the third characteristic of alcoholism. It talks to us about if you've tried to quit forever and you couldn't, or if you haven't had control when you started drinking. The third characteristic, I only find it mentioned once. It's on page 23. And this is the one that describes me to a T. It says, once in a while, he may tell the truth. That's about right. Once in a while, maybe. Yeah. I don't spread the truth around too thick. I save it for emergencies. I love Jack Nicholson's line in the movie As Good As It Gets. He says, I'll always give you some version of the truth. Makes perfect sense to me. Perfect sense. And so one of the ways that I played God was I lied. When I look at it, when I lie, I'm playing God. I am governing the outcome, irrespective of the means. So part of my spiritual awakening isn't that I don't lie. It's that when I'm lying, I know I'm playing God again. But I have to make amends for it. Bob referenced a concept that I presented in a different form. When I was sober about 2 years, I had these three character defects I was working on. That'll give you a brain hernia. And I was going to eradicate these. And they were drinking. I'm sorry. No, lying, swearing. And my attitude toward those of you who got your driver's licenses out of Cheerios boxes. I was working on those. And today I use them very effectively as my spiritual barometers. They're the things that tell me when I'm off the path. And I can't take power over that. I've lied to Bob this year on the phone, and I had to call back and make amends. You probably don't even remember that, but I do. And I get angry in traffic. Those things happen. And I do swear some, although I can report a real progress on that. For me, when I use profanity, it blurs the spiritual message. And so I try very hard not to do that. I make mistakes, and I just apologize and go on. I think it's okay that I make mistakes. Boy, I wish I knew where I was in this story.